This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What's the most dangerous army job in Iraq? Maybe it's defusing IEDs, car bombs, and other insidiously hidden explosives. Knowing that your 90-pound Kevlar bodysuit with protective ceramic panels will offer only limited protection if the bomb explodes. The new film, The Hurt Locker, is about an army bomb squad in Iraq, made up of three men, one who disarms the bombs and two sharpshooters who protect him while he works. My guests are the screenwriter, Mark Boal, and the director, Catherine Bigelow. Boal based the story on reporting he did in 2004, embedded with an army bomb squad in Baghdad. The movie In the Valley of Ella was based on one of his articles. Catherine Bigelow's other films include Strange Days, Near Dark, Point Break, and Blue Steel. The Hurt Locker is about the work of the bomb squad, but it's also about what leads men to choose this work and what the work does to them. Jeremy Renner stars as the sergeant who's just taken over the team. He's fearless and brilliant at defusing bombs, but often recklessly risks his life and the lives of his men. In this scene, Renner and one of his sharpshooters, played by Anthony Mackie, are in Renner's room. Mackie pulls out a box from under Renner's bed, filled with fuses, wires, and other remnants of bombs Renner has defused.
What do we have here?
They're, bomb parts, signatures.
Yeah, I see that, but what are they doing under your bed?
Well... this one. This one from the UN building. Flaming car, dead man switch, boom. This guy was good, I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
What about this one? Where's this one from, Will?
It's my wedding ring. Like I said, stuff that almost killed me.
Catherine Bigelow, Mark Boal, welcome to Fresh Air. In The Hurt Locker, we see bombs placed in all kinds of improbable places, including in a human body, in a corpse. And Mark, I'm wondering, what are some of the bomb situations you witnessed or were told about by the men you embedded with?
Well, I remember being in Iraq for probably less than 24 hours and somebody explaining to me quite casually that he could have very easily put a bomb under the chair I was sitting on as we were having that conversation and I would never know it. And just the realization that you can make a bomb that's small enough that, you know, it's no bigger than a bottle of water, really, and pretty much anywhere you could put a bottle of water, you could put a lethal device. And the insurgents in Iraq have been... very clever and ingenious about finding places to put IEDs. And the whole sort of name of the game of the war over there is the American military is looking for the IEDs. It's almost like a giant treasure hunt, sort of the wrong word, but it's a giant game of hide and seek. And the insurgency or the resisting force, whatever you want to call it, is trying their hardest to find hiding places. So they end up putting them everywhere is the short answer to your question. Anywhere you can imagine one being, they've tried.
Anywhere you can imagine, but what were some of the more unimaginable places?
Well, telephone poles, for example, was a sort of strange one. They started out very simply putting them in roads, in dirt roads, because it's easy to dig up a dirt road, put a bomb in it, cover up the dirt, and walk away. And as a result of that, the Americans got very careful about the dirt roads they would drive on, and they would select their routes to stay on hardtop tar roads, blacktop roads. And then so the insurgency switched and developed a method of ripping up the blacktop, putting a bomb underneath, and putting fresh blacktop over, and then aging the blacktop so it was indistinguishable from the rest of the road. So then the Americans developed techniques to trigger the bomb before it hit the blacktop, and then the insurgents started putting them farther off the road into, in some cases, telephone poles, in some cases, garbage cans, in vehicles of every kind, in donkey carts. It really is one of those things where the threat is so ubiquitous that it's impossible to say with any certainty where it's coming from, and that's part of what makes the experience in Iraq so anxiety-producing for people that are over there.
Catherine, the first IED that we see go off is in It's close to the beginning of the film. And it's a really horrifying moment. I mean, you basically see, and I think you shot this part of this in slow motion, you basically see the pavement lift up and fragment and fly into the air. And then everything else just kind of explode around it into this, you know, ball of debris. Can you talk a little bit about shooting that scene and making it have real impact? And by that, I mean, it's not special effects impact. There's so many movies where things are always blowing up and it's visually dazzling, but you don't necessarily feel anything. You're just thinking like, wow, pretty cool, stuff blowing up, big special effects. But this, you really feel the threat and the impact and the danger and the horror.
Well, I wanted to really put the viewer at the epicenter of the event and, you know, really feel that horror. And we shot the movie in the Middle East. We shot it in Amman, Jordan. That particular location happened to have been in a very densely populated area. In fact, it was near a customs house, and there was something like 200,000 cars that traveled through that area on a daily basis, although we did shut that part of the city down temporarily. But it was a very densely populated area, and we knew that had to be a form and type of detonation that was very palpable. When Mark spoke to the EOD techs in Baghdad, they spoke a lot about the fact that sometimes Hollywood movies, or in fact virtually in every case, the explosions in a Hollywood movie doesn't necessarily look like the real thing. A lot of it has to do with what the matter is that's being detonated. But we were very interested in trying to replicate it as realistically as possible. It's in the case of a 155, which was the particular ordnance in the middle of the road, it was meant to have a very dark, dense, thick look that was very different than those kind of gaseous orange plumes of kind of fuel that perhaps maybe is more conventional in films. Anyway, so we performed this detonation, and the effects man, Richard Stutzman, did an extraordinary job, but it was a very, very large, I think you could see it for, it was like a four-story high explosion that you could see for the, you know, miles and miles. And I used something called a phantom camera, which shoots 10,000 frames per second, you know, to kind of look at the granular nature of a detonation of that size.
Since you were setting off explosions that you could see four stories high, for anyone in the area in Jordan who was hearing or seeing the blast, how would they know that there wasn't like war breaking out down the street? How would they know for sure that this was a movie? How did you get the word out?
Well, there's actually a fairly evolved filmic infrastructure in Amman, Jordan. There's a film school as well. And many people in the area were actually aware that we were filming. We actually had been filming in the area for several days prior to the explosion. We were able to communicate with all of the individuals, all of the owners of shops, and get the word out that this explosion was coming. So it was not something that was of any kind of surprise.
Mark, when you were embedded with a bomb squad in Iraq, how close did you get to any of the explosions?
Well, I got, you know, when you're embedded, unfortunately or fortunately, you're just sort of right there with the soldiers. So I was as close as the soldiers would be. And, it depended. If they were a mile away, I was a mile away. If they were 100 yards away, I was 100 yards away. And close enough that you can feel the heat of the explosion, which is really quite impressive and intensive. It's almost like someone's taking a hairdryer and spraying it in your face. And obviously close enough that the shrapnel is whizzing by around you. And you know, it's very loud and percussive. It's like being in a rock concert.
And does the bomb squad team have a pretty decent idea of what the range of the blast will be if the blast goes off, so that they know what the safety zone is?
They do. They're kind of they have a very keen sense of that, actually, and their whole expertise in terms of the physics of it is quite extraordinary and impressive. I mean, these are guys that are actually trained to defuse nuclear bombs. So for them to calculate the physical blast radius of an IED is something they can do. It's the kind of math they can do in their head very quickly. And so they can tell you with a pretty high degree of certainty where the blast is going to is going to go and what the impact will be on a given structure, whether it'll take down a house or put a hole in a house or whatever. But again, that's assuming that they know exactly what the content of the bomb is, and some of the time they don't really know.
Part of the drama in The Hurt Locker comes from those moments when the when the person from the bomb squad, whose job it is to defuse the bomb, puts on the suit and does the walk alone to the bomb. And it seems like it would be one of the most lonely moments imaginable, because you're cut off from the world by virtue of wearing this 90-pound suit, protective suit. And then also, it's just like you there, basically right next to the bomb, trying to defuse it. Mark, would you talk a little bit about the reality of that situation, like what you witnessed when it was time for one of the men to take that walk alone?
It's an everyday occurrence, so I don't want to over-dramatize it, but there is something extremely iconic about that, and the bomb techs always talk about that walk, and it's really a mark of honor if you've done it, and it's really hard to quantify or explain if you haven't. But basically, once you put on that suit and you start walking towards the bomb, you're in a world at a certain point in which there is no turning back. And if the bomb goes off, you're dead. If you turn around and run and the bomb goes off, you're dead. So the only option is to really go right into the teeth of the matter and defuse it. And they talk about how profoundly transfixing that moment can be, and how at a certain point, say it's 50 meters out, you tend to have thoughts about your family or your friends or whatever, and then at 25 meters out, maybe your thought process changes and your heart is now beating so fast that it's really just a kind of instinctual adrenaline moment, and all the way to the moment when you're actually standing over the bomb, and it's really literally impossible to think about anything other than the simple mechanics of defusing the bomb.
Since some of the IEDs could be detonated remotely by, for instance, a cell phone, for the sharpshooters, if they saw anybody with a cell phone, at least like in the movie, they wouldn't know whether that cell phone was a detonator or just a phone. And so you're confronted with the decision, shoot or not. Is that something that the men you embedded with talked to you about or that you witnessed?
Yeah, and you know, what was just so hair-raising about the whole thing is that all these little kind of moments of everyday life that we never think about as being particularly threatening or not take on this whole new aspect when you're in a war zone, and somebody taking out a cell phone and looking at you as he's talking on the phone, you wonder if he's, you know, is he calling his wife and saying, "I'll take the roast beef for dinner tonight, honey," or is he calling his friend who is an insurgent and saying, "Hey, if you come across town, you can get a easy pot shot on a bunch of Americans right now." And it's just really, it's the combination of the lethality of the IEDs and the unknowability for somebody that doesn't speak Arabic or that isn't really versed in the culture of, you know, of the motives of the people around you that makes it so hair-raising. And in particular, the thing that they would talk about is the cell phones and also people signaling with flags and kites and that kind of thing. And there was a whole sort of semiotics to that of trying to figure out whether somebody putting a carpet out on their doorstep was that because they were trying to clean their carpet, or was that because they were trying to signal the neighbor across the street that there were Americans coming?
Let's talk a little bit about the casting. I mean, I think everybody who sees the film feels this way. One of the things that really throws you is that there are several pretty famous actors in the movie, including Ralph Fiennes and Guy Pearce. And, you know, you see them and you think, oh, you know, at first you think, oh, they're going to be the hero of the film. But, I mean, they're not necessarily, they don't even necessarily survive. And the people who are the real leads in the film, you've probably never seen before or seen only in small roles. And you think, that's a familiar face. Where did I see them? It's like reverse casting with the lesser known people in the big roles and the well-known people in the small roles. Why did you do that?
Well, part of it was to intensify and increase the element of suspense and tension, and that you're looking at a face, you're looking at an individual for whom you have kind of an awareness of, but not necessarily a specific, you know, he or she, or he in this case, doesn't come with a kind of provenance that therefore will protect him. In other words, this is a major movie star. He can't nothing can happen to him, his life won't be in peril till the end of the film. But if you take that out of the equation, then you're looking at these particular faces and looking at these characters, and anything is possible. And so I think it sort of amplifies the tension. And then taking a more familiar face and putting them in harm's way, it just kind of takes the balance and makes it more surprising, I think.
You cast Jeremy Renner as the person who's the lead person in the bomb squad team. He's the person who actually defuses the bomb. And he's a real hot dog. I mean, he is totally into risk, and he's willing to not only risk his life, but to risk the lives of the other men on the squad in ways that are unnecessary and that violate protocol. How did you cast Jeremy Renner in that role? And tell us who he is, because most people will not have seen him before.
Well, Jeremy Renner, in my opinion, is probably one of the most talented actors of his generation. And he's been in actually quite a few independent films and some semi-larger films, but in smaller roles. And I became aware of him in a movie called Dahmer, where he played Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial killer. And he elicited so much honesty and truth and actual empathy for a character of whom I couldn't even imagine having empathy for. And so I thought that it was a pretty profoundly evocative performance, and I was determined to work with him. And then as Mark was developing the script, I began to see Jeremy Renner in that character of Sergeant James, who has a kind of bravado and a swagger and an almost reckless quality, but combined with a profoundly able and capable skill set. And so, you know, I needed to create in that character and have an actor that can provide the authority to pull that paradox off.
Catherine, one of the things that made an impression on me in the movie is that occasionally there'd be like a stray feral cat walking across the street or down the street. And like one of the cats has only three functioning legs. And one of the cats just looks half like starved to death and unhealthy and kind of afraid. And I was wondering, like, whether you cast these cats, or whether these were like stray cats that you found or that were actually happened to be walking down the street.
In all honesty, they happened to be walking down the street. Kind of the bonus of shooting in situ in a environment. It was in an area that was sort of, I suppose, kind of downmarket, shall we say. And so it's a matter of always keeping your camera department alive and looking in all directions just in case there might be some surprise. A beautiful woman up on a balcony, head shrouded in cloth, looking down, gazing down on you, and just trying to be very sensitive to the environment in which you're in and open and spontaneous and take that into consideration where you're shooting.
You know, one of the things I got the impression of from your movie is that your movie is in part about men who have no talent for ordinary life, for life on the home front, for ordinary family life, that something is stirred in them being on the front lines, being in danger, being in a bomb squad, you know, that kind of work. But at the same time, you reach a point where you can't take that anymore either, and then what are you left with? And I guess I'd just be interested in some of the thoughts you had during the making of the movie about people for whom ordinary life isn't enough, isn't pleasurable or fulfilling in any way.
Well, I don't know if you're familiar with Chris Hedges' book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning.
Yes.
It's a pretty extraordinary piece of writing, and he discusses that very fact, the sense of purpose and meaning that moments of peak experience can provide. In this case, we're obviously referencing combat, and as Mark mentioned earlier, it could come with, you know, race car driving, or again, moments of peak experience, that once that captures your imagination, it's a very difficult feeling, sensation, emotional peak to replicate other than in that context.
Well, Mark Boll, Catherine Bigelow, congratulations on the film. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Catherine Bigelow directed the new film The Hurt Locker. Mark Boll wrote the screenplay. You can watch clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Soldiers who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan can still tell stories about how they died through their autopsies. It was the decision of my guest, Captain Craig Malik, to perform autopsies and CT scans on all of the fallen in Iraq and Afghanistan. Malik is a Navy pathologist who is the chief of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System, which is part of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. Captain Malik performed some of the autopsies himself. The results are made available to families of the dead and to researchers who are trying to learn how to better protect American soldiers. Consider this famous quote from the Annals of Pathology: "Let conversation cease, let laughter flee. This is the place where the dead come to the aid of the living." Captain Malik, welcome to Fresh Air. Since your office has done so many autopsies and CT scans of the fallen in Iraq and Afghanistan, what are some of the fatal injuries that you've seen that have helped you understand where our men and women are most vulnerable and how we can overcome those vulnerabilities through either better medical equipment, better medical technology, better armor?
Well, our service members die in a variety of ways, as you can imagine, in a time of war. Some of them are similar to what is seen in the United States with gunshot wounds or drownings. But we also see a number of blast injuries, and that has been one of our major focuses on is how to protect our members when they encounter a blast device such as an IED or another munition that is designed to hurt or kill them. And that information and those wounding patterns are provided to those who designed this material in an effort to provide better coverage, provide better vehicle design.
So can you give us an example of how a vehicle or how armor or medical technology has been redesigned as a result of what you've been seeing in autopsies and CT scans of the dead?
We don't talk too much about it because those changes then would be known to those that are trying to hurt our young men and women out there. So, but in the medical field, we did help redesign a way to treat a collapsed lung, or it's called a pneumothorax is the medical term, and we found that the catheters being used by the emergency responders were not long enough to get into the chest cavity to release the air that's trapped there. And over the course of about a month, we looked at 100 different chest wall thicknesses, and we found that our soldiers and Marines have thicker chest walls than those of the average American, and the needles were not penetrating the chest cavity. So the Army Surgeon General sent out a memo and changed the methodology to treat these injuries and hopefully save lives.
So is this because men in the military are more bulked up, that they work out more, so they have bigger chest muscles, and therefore the tubing isn't long enough to get to the collapsed lung?
It wasn't long enough to get into the chest cavity, and that's probably true. They're also a younger population in general, where you don't want to use a too long needle where you could actually go in and damage something. We found that that wasn't the case with our American military, that are young and in very good physical shape, that by using this longer needle, it wasn't placing them at any additional risk, but it was needed to provide the appropriate medical treatment.
Now, the process of autopsying and providing CT scans for all the fallen in Iraq and Afghanistan, this is like a relatively new policy that I believe was started under your tenure with the medical examiner system. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. In previous conflicts, they did some autopsies in Korea and in Vietnam, and a very few in the first Gulf War. But at the beginning of this conflict, our office decided as a group that we were going to fully account for each of the fallen, and that included a complete examination and then providing information to the families so they had a better understanding of what happened to their loved one.
So how does this work? Do the loved ones automatically get sent a copy of the autopsy and the CT scan, or Do they need to ask for it in order to get it?
When families are notified that their loved one is deceased, they are provided with a fact sheet about our involvement, and in that fact sheet is all the information they need to get an autopsy report. And they send that in to our office, and we provide them with the autopsy report. If they ask for the pictures or the CT scans, we provide them, but only upon request.
So what information could, you know, a person who's not a medical expert get from the autopsy or the CT scan?
Well, many times the families are not able to view the remains at the funeral due to the severity of the injury. And weeks and months later, they have questions about exactly what happened to my loved one and was that really them? And we provide that information in the autopsy report, not only the description of the wounds, but also how we identified them. We don't accept visual identifications that another soldier says, yes, that's my buddy. We require fingerprint, dental, or DNA identification. And sometimes even families want beyond that. They'll want a picture of a tattoo or a picture of some part, a scar on the body, and we'll provide that to them to help them accept that, yes, this was their loved one and they did die.
I know that when you send out the reports to loved ones, it includes a note saying, don't look at this alone. Why do you give that advice?
Well, we care very deeply for these families, and a lot of the information in these reports is very, very graphic. And reading them alone, we've learned over the years, is a very difficult thing for families. We receive feedback from families. They'll call us on a regular basis and they'll say, yes, I really needed to do that with someone else, or I read it alone and I shouldn't have. That going through that and reading about exactly what happened can be very traumatic on the family, and we're trying to help them. The last thing we want to do is make it worse for them. So for them to have somebody willing to support them often provides that bridge and helps them get through that so that they can understand the injuries and what happened, but still have that support system right there with them. It's worked over the years, and the families have said that this is the right thing to do, so we continue to encourage them to have support around when they read our reports.
What kind of information have you found that families find most reassuring as opposed to just upsetting when they read the autopsies?
Well, from the feedback that we receive from families, the information about the identification is very important to them.
To know for sure this is really my loved one. It's just like, you know, because it's not, like you said, it's not like they're going to view the remains.
No, not in all cases. In some cases,
they do. Mm-hmm.
And that's a mortuary decision. It's not our decision. That is made by the morticians, and they make recommendations to the family. And the family can actually, if they want to view a set of remains even after being warned not to, they're entitled to do so. But when our mortuary colleagues recommend that you don't view the remains, it's for a reason.
How much direct contact do you have with families?
Between 85 and 90% of the families have requested reports, and probably 10% of that number call us back.
What kind of questions do they usually ask?
They ask about the medical terminology. They ask about the wounds. They ask about the suffering, of course, is always a major topic. They also want to know about any natural diseases that we may have identified and whether that's something that their family should be monitoring. If the soldier had children or brothers or sisters, if we found something that's potentially a life-threatening condition that we didn't know about before they went off to Iraq or Afghanistan, that is also discussed with them at length and how to approach their family physician with this information.
Do you end up getting close to families who you talk to?
We provide them support as much as they need, and they can call as often as they want. Do we get close to them? Do we get personal with them. No, we are there to support them, but like any physician, it's more of a physician-patient relationship than a personal relationship.
Do families often feel this like bond with you or the other people in your office who perform the autopsies because you were the last people to see the remains, handle the remains, or really like analyze the remains of their loved ones, and that makes you an important witness to what happened to their loved ones? So does that mean that the families feel a certain connection to you?
Not a large number, but there are a few that will call us repeatedly, and even years later will just want to call and talk to us. And exactly what you said, that we were the last ones that had this chance to be with them. Other than the funeral directors, we're the ones that were their final doctor. We're the ones that gave them their final, in some ways, it's a physical. And they will come back to us repeatedly and just to talk about their family and or talk about their loved one, or if there's something that's happened with the family that they would come back and ask us if there was anything we could contribute to that. Say there's another death in the family, is there something that we can help them with? And we're available 24/7 for them anytime, anywhere.
When you say we, does that include you?
That includes me.
So do you have a cell phone on 24/7 to deal with families?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us more about what those conversations are like?
We've learned that the death really for families has, their reaction has really no boundaries. And we, when we talk to them, we see every emotion that you can think of, from being very upset to them being very thankful for us making sure that their loved one did come home and it was fully accounted for, to sometimes being very upset with the system, being upset with the way things are handled. But we're there, and everybody in the casualty system and the medical examiner's office, we just do our best to meet their needs.
What does the CT scan show that a regular autopsy would not?
Well, the CT scan takes approximately 3,000 cross-sectional x-rays in about 5 minutes. And our radiologists and our program manager are able to reconstruct the entire body then in three dimension, which can be examined in any angle. It can be looked at and turned. You can look at just soft tissue. You can look at just bone injuries. You can look at where the armor is because it shows up on the CT scans. So it gives you a complete three-dimensional reconstruction record that we will have forever for researchers and designers and developers for years and decades to come.
So when you do the CT scan, it's of the soldier as they fell? In other words, they're wearing their clothing, they're wearing their armor, so that you could better understand what happened?
Yes, if there's no resuscitation, we asked back in 2004, much like our civilian colleagues in the medical exam world do, that the body be left alone, that it be made safe, but after that, that just be left alone and sent to Dover so that we can collect the same types of information in a forensic fashion that we were taught to do along with our civilian colleagues. And we couldn't do that if they took the bodies, took the clothes off, washed them down. Much of the evidence is lost then.
Is the CT scanner you use different than the ones we would find if we were getting a CT scan for health problems in the States as civilians?
It's a little different. When we started this program back in 2004, we received a clinical CT scanner, which you would recognize. And if you saw our CT scanner right now, you wouldn't, looking at it, you wouldn't notice any difference. But what we found is that a clinical CT scanner is not designed to do a full-body CT scan at the highest resolution repeatedly in a course of a morning if we have 4, 5, 6 cases. And there were problems with components burning out. And we also found that the table was only moved 5 feet 2 inches, and most of our military members are far taller than that. And the opening through which the body passes through was also too small for the bodies to pass through with the body armor on. And also some of our Marines and soldiers are very large, and they didn't fit through the opening in the CT scanner. So our partner redesigned the CT scanner just for our needs, and it was replaced 1.5 years ago with one that's designed for forensic use.
How is the body preserved until the autopsy can be done?
Working very close again with our mortuary affairs colleagues, the bodies are collected as quickly as possible, and then they're placed on ice, and the temperature is monitored throughout the process. And it usually takes less than 48 hours for them to arrive back in Dover. Of course, there'll be cases where the body's not recovered right away for a number of reasons, there is some decomposition in those cases, but we try to minimize that, and we work very hard to make sure that the decomposition is as minimal as possible so the family can have a viewing if they so desire.
What happens when a soldier has been killed by an explosion and you get, say, body parts, and then later on you get another body part? Do you have a system so that you can analyze if a body part comes in after the rest of the body, that it's part of the same remains?
Yes, often the bodies are fragmented. And again, it's a family-driven process. If the medical examiner decides that the body is not complete, a letter is given to the family informing them of that, and they are given the opportunity to decide whether they would like to be notified if we're able to identify any additional portions that we may have already, but we have to run the DNA on, or may come in later. And if we do make identification, the family is notified. And when they are notified, they're asked again, if we find something else, do you want to be notified? And that goes on as long as the family keeps saying yes every time something is identified. And we've had portions identified weeks to months later, and some families say, no, that's enough. We had closure, we're done. Other families say, no, I want to know every time you make an identification. And we do what the families ask us to do.
Now, in addition to the autopsies and CT scans that your office conducts on the men and women who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan, you've also consulted on cases of alleged torture and assaults on detainees. Can you tell us a little bit about those cases?
Yes. Again, using our civilian model, we saw detainees the same as prisoners that would be in jail in any state in the Union. And in most states, they require anyone that's in the custody of the state to have an autopsy if they die while in custody of that state. And using that model, anytime we had a death of a detainee, we use the same methods and do a complete forensic examination to either rule in or rule out any allegations of torture or mistreatment.
So did you find torture or mistreatment?
We found injury patterns, and whether it's actually torture or not is for the courts to decide, but we will find injury patterns that concern us, and we will give that feedback to the law enforcement agencies such as the Army Criminal Investigation Division or the Navy Criminal Investigative Service, and then that information goes forward as they prepare for a prosecution of a possible assailant.
So what kind of patterns have you seen?
You can see, you know, a variety of patterns, from blunt force injury to gunshot wounds. And it doesn't always mean that it's torture. It just means that those patterns are there and those injuries are there. And at times, it's those patterns had nothing to do with American service members. It may have happened before they actually came into our custody. And that is all to be sorted out by the investigative agencies. And it also includes the FBI's involved in some of these cases.
No, I think your office had to ID the bodies of Saddam Hussein and his two sons. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you talk a little bit about how that was done?
Well, when the two sons were killed, we were called to Iraq and we did our examinations and we took a forensic dentist with us. And they actually had dental records. And we were able to, through their dental records, make identification on them. And then we collected, of course, DNA samples like we do on every case, and we had those profiles. And when Saddam Hussein was captured, we had his son's DNA profiles, which were able to compare with that of Saddam Hussein and able to match that up.
And I guess it was actually really important with Saddam Hussein because he had body doubles, so it was always possible that the person who was discovered was really a body double who was hiding out as a decoy.
That was a possibility, and that's why we, our DNA lab is one of, it is the gold standard in the world, and we were able to turn that case around very quickly so that the leadership in the government and the military had a positive identification.
So do you do the hands-on autopsies, or do you just oversee other people doing them?
I don't do as many as the rest of the staff do, but I still do autopsies on a regular basis to maintain my skills and to maintain that sense of the importance of the mission.
Are there families who ever ask that you don't perform an autopsy because they think that the autopsy will somehow desecrate the body or violate their religious views about death and the body?
We have very few. It's surprisingly few that requests that we don't do our examination. And we talk with them at length and explain to them exactly why we're doing what we're doing. And usually that works out just fine. Sometimes, once in a great, great while, I'm talking less than a handful of cases since 2002, it's had to go beyond that, where we've had to do extensive counseling with the family and had other types of professionals involved. If they have a religious objection, we provide religious support at Dover. If they would like a certain type of clergy there while we're doing our examination, or there's certain limitations that some religions have on autopsies, we'll observe all of those. And we've done our best to meet all those concerns of the family, and to date it has not been a problem.
Is it hard for you to not only be around so much death, but this is a death caused by war, which is in some ways the worst of humanity. So is that hard? And if so, what do you do to counteract that, to keep yourself sane?
We view these young men and women as the very best that the United States has. They have volunteered their service in the defense of all of us, and they deserve to be treated, whether they're alive or dead, with the best care possible. And their families deserve our best to bring them the answers that they deserve. And that's what drives us every day, just keeping that focus. If we lose that focus, that's when it's time to leave.
Do you feel like you've been changed in any fundamental way, or that your view of death has been changed in any fundamental way from doing the work that you do?
I think doing this work for anybody, it does change you over the years. There's no way for it not to. I don't think it's necessarily a bad or a good way. It's just that as this becomes part of your life, there are things that you look at differently. There's things that you appreciate more. When I leave in the morning from home, I always make sure I'm on, my wife and I, we never leave on sour terms, where everything is fine when I go off to work or she goes off to work, because we understand how fragile life is, and that we may never see each other again. We know the chances are small, but we'd never want to take that chance.
Captain Malik, thank you so much for talking about your work with us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome, ma'am.
Captain Craig Malik is chief of the Armed Forces Medical Examiner System. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.